This place is jam-packed. Steve Doctor, Death Williams, and I'll be describing the action. And two of the biggest men in all of wrestling, they're going to get it on right here in just a moment. Big Bubba Rogers and the one-man gang.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 159 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And despite the lovely Sammy Hagar song playing in the background that's from the movie Over the Top, it'd be a great episode if I was actually reviewing the movie Over the Top. Actually, I should probably write that down. Maybe that would be a good idea for the future, since I've never actually seen that movie, and it would be kind of, it would go be right in line with my reacting to stuff that I'm seeing for the first time idea I had for wrestling from 2003 to 2010. But of course, this is part two in my series on the end of the UWF, but this is a new beginning for them. New theme song, which apparently was just for 1 week because they just threw in this Sammy Hagar song to get us all fired up and then went back to that bass line the following week. So no longer is this checking in with Grandpa Bill Watts. This is now officially a Jim Crockett Promotions joint taped April 19th from Muskogee, Oklahoma. I really had to think hard how to pronounce that, but the easiest way to remember how to pronounce that is the old Merle Haggard song, Okie from Muskogee.
And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. A place where even squares can have a ball.
I don't have the greatest knowledge of Merle Haggard's work. However, when I looked it up, I did not know that his backing band is called The Strangers, which I thought was somewhat fitting given where this show was taped, because it would be a stranger walking in the door and winning the UWF title. I'm sorry, spoiler alert, but, you know, it kind of goes into some of the issues with this show and the world title change that we will see on it. But before I get into all that, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. You may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Do check out the other great shows on Pro Wrestling Only. I am pleased to see that WorldCast will be coming back soon. I guess Kelly Nelson is back from Malta. You know, he's finally done looking for Baron Cicluna, and in fact, yes, the Baron is in fact deceased, so he could just go right on back to Canada and keep doing podcasts on World Class as they roll in to 1984. And I'm pretty fired up for that, because I think I talked several weeks ago about how I've watched some world-class early 84 shows. I'm not quite to the David Von Erich death, and I also get distracted by the Ruthless Aggression documentaries, but I'll go back into that. And besides, I also want to find a world-class show to cover at some point in the month of April or May, because this is another one of those rare times where not only after choosing these two shows, these back-to-back weeks of UWF television, I have three WWF shows the next 3 weeks, which will, I did this 2 years ago where I was covering shows in the lead up to various WrestleManias, and my idea coming up is to do the lead up to a WrestleMania from the 80s, one from the 90s, and one actually from the 2000s. So that should be a lot of fun over the next 3 weeks. But there's a couple of world class shows that I would certainly like to get to. But I'm also obsessed with UWF television after having watched a lot of these 87 shows. It's not bad by any means. There are some problems with it that I'll get into. But let me just rewind, because last week we had the clock change here in the United States, and I presume Canada, because, you know, you want to keep the clocks lined up in North America. And I think I've spoken about this on the podcast. I've now had, what, four cracks at it with this clock change where we move an hour ahead. It's not that I have a problem with daylight saving time. It's that I have a problem with the needless clock change and the fact that we have to go back and forth. And I've suggested now an idea that seems patently ridiculous but should appeal to both parties, where we set the clocks 40 minutes ahead and we just leave it there. The reason being, because the Democrats would like it, because it would, you know, make daylight saving time permanent, which is something that they like. And Trump and the Republicans would like it because it's telling the rest of the world, hey, we're setting our clocks to a weird number 40 minutes ahead, so go ahead and try and match us because we're America and we're number one. So I do think that's something that both parties would agree on, which is something that's in very short supply, I think, these days. Now, also, last week, I talked about SummerSlam tickets and my weird efforts to try and get a suite and then getting screwed over by my fan relations rep, not understanding how to read pricing back to me. I loved his BS response to me. Was, oh, I was reading the price of last year's SummerSlam tickets. Like, yes, I'm sure you were telling me the price of SummerSlam, which was in Toronto last year. I don't think you were looking at the house show prices from last year. I think he was just flaky and whatever. But I did end up procuring enough tickets for myself and for Keithy, if he wants to go. I mean, that's entirely up to him. I know that some people would rather just stay home and watch it on the network for $10. Of course, who knows what'll happen between now and then. It might be on ESPN for $60 or whatever the hell they charge for the UFC. I don't know what WWE would be looking at for a big four pay-per-view like SummerSlam. We shall see if WWE makes any sort of changes to the network vis-a-vis pay-per-views, especially those big four ones. I would assume SummerSlam would be the first of those if they were to act on it. However, we don't know what's going to happen with WrestleMania and the coronavirus thing, which I'm of the belief that as the weather gets warmer, this thing is going to die down, I think, a little bit. I mean, I'm not running out and getting hand sanitizer, although I'm lucky enough that I had one of those little ones that I have at work. I'm not taking it home with me each day because that thing's like leaving a gold bullion brick on my desk. Like, I'm not leaving that there for any cleaning person to swipe that for their own thing. But as I'm not going to WrestleMania, I actually canceled my hotel room formally, or my reservation, last week because I'm just not going to be able to do it. We got SummerSlam here in Boston in August, and what I think is that this thing will die down by that point. So I would not say that that event is in any danger, but I am a little worried about WrestleMania. Not because I think Vince McMahon would cancel it, because this is a man who had a performer, I don't mean to laugh, but a performer literally died in the middle of a show, and he kept going. Probably because he was thinking of having to refund all those pay-per-view dollars that he was going to get for whatever the hell it was, In Your House, Over the Edge in 1999 with Owen Hart dying in the middle of the show. But the way this is played out, I don't think the decision is going to be entirely in his hands, especially when you have government authorities shutting down various events. You know, South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. That's another one where I was kind of surprised, but given, I think we're pretty close to the height of this thing in terms of the paranoia, you can't say that there's a lack of awareness of what's going on here. I mean, I think everybody knows what's going on and, you know, what they need to do. But with SummerSlam only being about 4 weeks away, and with, you know, some cases in Tampa, there's actually a chance. Now, again, I don't think that that would happen. However, tongue in cheek, given that I do have a couple of extra tickets for SummerSlam, and the odds of the product becoming hot between now and then and raising the value of those tickets is slim, I'm tongue in cheek saying cancel Mania, double SummerSlam. That's my policy, because they're never going to have a WrestleMania in Boston ever again. I'm constantly going to have to travel for WrestleMania, so might as well make SummerSlam as big as you possibly can. In fact, you know, why not have it at Gillette Stadium? Oh wait, there's probably NFL preseason games. But hey, you know what? I'm just satisfied with the fact that the weather is warming up here finally. as I taped this on a Monday, it was 73 degrees outside when I was working in the middle of the day, which I go out without a coat, go across the street, buy some chicken fingers, some awful chicken fingers from Stop and Shop. Like, why is it that when I go out to lunch for work, I just eat like the worst possible stuff? Like the pizza when I worked at my last job in the cafeteria was some of the worst pizza ever, but yet I could not stop eating it. I'm looking forward to this coming weekend. I'm going up to Burlington, Vermont with the wife. We did this a year ago around this time, and I enjoy that place very much. Of course, I looked at the seven-day forecast, and it's going to be in the mid-30s up there, the coldest day of the week in Burlington, Vermont. So I'm just hoping that it doesn't snow. And if it does, I'm hoping that there's enough ice on Lake Champlain that I could go ice skating out there. But sadly, with the winter being as warm as it's been, I really don't think that that's going to happen. And with that, I'm just going to stop on a dime and start talking about this particular UWF television show. And stop on a dime is the operative phrase because the elements of this show bear little resemblance to what came before it. Like, you could tell that something has changed if you had just watched the previous week and now this. After all, you watched a show last week where they put 11 guys in the top 10 contenders for the UWF title. And who's challenging the one-man gang for said title on this show? None of those 11 guys. Instead, we get Big Bubba Rogers from Jim Crockett Promotions, who is not necessarily a title contender there. Certainly in the middle of the mid-card is where I would put him. So you kind of wonder, okay, well, what the hell is going on here? Is this some sort of power play by JCP? Probably. But I think that there are other extenuating circumstances that people might not necessarily be talking about. I just wonder why Big Bubba had to be on the other side of this. Bill Watts is out. He's just completely left the wrestling business, not to be seen again for nearly 5 years when he turns up in WCW in the spring of 1992. So you got to turn elsewhere for that, I don't want to say authority figure, because it's not portrayed the same way as it has been in modern wrestling. But the presentation overall just seems very, very different. It's hard to describe how, but it just feels different than it did before. A lot of people bring up, well, couldn't they have done an invasion angle where either the UWF crashes JCP or JCP crashes UWF? Well, you kind of actually did have that with Big Bubba coming in. But they probably were not thinking, we're like, okay, we're going to emulate the model in Japan where you had Ricky Choshu's guys invading the promotion. Like, I don't think that that's something that was in the forefront of people's minds at that time. Now, when you get to the mid-90s and you got Eric Bischoff, who, for all of his flaws, was aware of what was going on the other side of the world, then it becomes more plausible and lucrative, as it turned out. Well, at least for a little while. My thought of the UWF and JCP and how they should have played this going forward is, yeah, you can keep them separate, and in fact, they probably should have just stayed the course with the booking in the UWF. The big problem with that is they were going to have trouble maintaining the people who were there, like a Ted DiBiase, like other guys who are going out the door, and I'm actually going to run down that top 10 list from last week, and it's like, okay, well, where do those guys end up going? They don't necessarily have contracts with any of these places. They're just, or because you got the new ownership coming in, and they don't know Crockett and how everything will work with them, they're probably not going to be given preferential treatment versus any Crockett guys who might come in. So they're looking for an exit any way they can. But the guys that you want to stay, JCP, should reach out to them and actually, give them a push, maybe sign them to a contract so they're not fleeing for the WWF, which just put on WrestleMania 3. So the money is certainly on the table from that perspective. And you got Rick Steiner and Sting now as the tag team champions. So clearly they had that in mind for those two guys, but others just kind of slipped through their fingers, as it turned out. But just kind of as an exercise of who we're dealing with in the UWF at the very end as it transitions under Jim Crockett Promotions control, just take those top 10 guys. I'm going to leave out Eddie Gilbert, the television champion, just so we can have an even 10 from the previous week. Your number 10 and your number 9 are the former tag team champions. 10 is Terry Taylor, 9 is Chris Adams. Taylor is there for much of the rest of the year. In fact, he's the UWF TV champion later in the year. He's part of that unification match with Nikita Koloff at the end. So I guess he's not the last television champion. I guess that would be Nikita. But he has a car accident in the month of June, and that would really harm the angle that they had set up fairly well with his former tag team partner, Chris Adams. And Adams does not stay in the UWF very long because I don't think Jim Crockett Promotions were as keen on having a guy who did time in the previous year for headbutting a pilot, which I went into chapter and verse on last week's show. Number 8 is Iceman Parsons. He doesn't really stick around too long. He ends up in Wild West Wrestling along with Ken Mantell, who was the guy you saw on commentary last week who was booking the UWF in its later stages. Parsons then ends up in World Class in 1988. At number 7, you got Sam Houston, who's in the WWF for better or worse within weeks of this. And I talked about how, why would you choose Sam Houston over Eddie Gilbert from the perspective of, well, Eddie's too small, but we're going to bring in Sam Houston. It's something they never quite understood. Now, it might be that Sam Houston was more willing to play a role, which was a jobber to the stars type thing, versus Eddie Gilbert, who would have rather be the big fish in the smaller pond. Number 6, Chavo Guerrero Sr. He's pretty much winding down his career. He's not going to be in the UWF for very much longer. He's got the feud going on with Gary Young at this point. Of course, Young, he's nowhere to be found in this top 10. So, you know, just kind of winding things up for him. Number 5 is Michael Hayes. The Freebirds stay strong through 87. They're pretty much UWF mainstays, but they're also the kind of unit that you could drop into Jim Crockett Promotions every now and then because they're known anywhere that they would go. So he would be utilized in both places. And as the talker of the group, he was somebody that was important to keep around towards that end. Hayes, like Parsons, ends up back in World Class by the time 1988 rolls around. Also, Chris Adams and Terry Taylor end up there as well. So, almost kind of like a refugee camp down in Fritzland. Savannah Jack was number 4. He basically had like a career-ending heart ailment, as I remember it. So, his career is winding down as well. Number 3, Ted DiBiase. He goes to the WWF and appears on the Houston Wrestling Show not very long after this. It's within the month of May 1987. And something that I covered back in my Ted DiBiase special that I did, God, nearly 3 years ago. It was, I think, around episode 20, 21, somewhere in the middle there. And that was kind of a half-hour quick-hit thing on the odd Ted DiBiase. We have to turn him heel for the Houston market prior to him becoming the Million Dollar Man. And then tied for second, so our last two are Terry Gordy and Dr. Death Steve Williams. And they kind of go on different paths. Gordy is around as a member of the Freebirds, but he's also got Japan in his back pocket. And 87's the year that he starts tagging with Stan Hansen in All Japan. Dr. Death, he of course has Japan as well, but he eventually becomes the UWF heavyweight champion for the second half of 1987. But then things kind of peter out. He gets busted for drugs in early 1988, and then he becomes more of a Japanese wrestling figure than in the United States for varying reasons. So I have to reiterate, though, the shows, like, I watch pretty much every UWF TV show from May of 87. It's not bad. They aren't hitting home runs with every angle that they're doing. I mean, I really don't care about Chavo Guerrero and Gary Young all that much, but the Terry Taylor, Chris Adams thing, that's very well built. We're going to hear more from them on this show. They actually have their last match as a tag team on television, as it turns out, on this program as well. Dr. Death Steve Williams now on the UWF World Title track. Ted DiBiase's longtime tag team partner is out the door, but Dr. Death is a longtime mainstay of the territory, so it's natural that, you know, he would be built up for that chase that would culminate in the month of July. And the Freebirds in Devastation Inc. is something that holds my interest as well. I don't know, maybe it's because I have a thing for great heel factions when they turn babyface. I'm fascinated by that, and that goes all the way up to the Shield in 2014 and enjoying that run while it lasted in the first half of that year before WWE decided to make all their booking turn to shit for pretty much the next 5 years. But anyway, that's just one man's opinion. I mean, you know, what can I really say about that? I'm not here to talk about the modern product. I'm here to talk about old wrestling from the 80s. And, you know, the 1987 UWF, like I said, I'm quite interested in this. And a lot of it is on YouTube. So you just have to know where to look. Just don't tell anybody, because I don't know. I don't know if this UWF stuff, like, it's not on the network. In fact, if you look for Mid-South Wrestling, nothing is there after it's renamed the UWF. I think it stops at, like, March 3rd, 1986, and I was watching that the other day. I'm like, well, why the hell can't they post more of this? And who knows? Maybe they don't think there's the audience for it, but, you know, I enjoy doing these Mid-South shows, and it's not like the time I did the 2012 WWE show where nobody listened to it. I mean, you know, I think the numbers do okay for this. So without any further ado, why don't I just get right into it? UWF TV from May 2nd, 1987.
On the inside, that's on the line with Gary Stevens hanging tough as they turn for home a quarter of a mile to go. Beck twice taking the lead by one. On the outside, here comes Ali Sheba on the line, dropping out of it. Middle of the racetrack, crypto clearance, but Jose Santos is flying Leo Castelli between horses. And down the stretch they come. Beck twice on the inside, leads it by a head. On the outside, here comes Ali Sheba. Ali Sheba with Chris McCarron to the front. Beck twice back to second. Here's the finish. Ali Sheba wins it by three parts of a length.
Usually I'm not fortunate enough to get a major sporting event on the day that the show that I'm covering aired, but it is the first Saturday in May, so it is the Kentucky Derby. 87 Derby, particularly exciting, because you had Bet Twice, a heavy favorite, Ali Sheba, coming down the stretch. A very popular horse, I might add, because the guts that Ali Sheba showed in that race, almost knocked on his freaking face in the home stretch, which, by the way, the announcer didn't see fit to actually point that out, that almost freaking toppled over and then made a strong closing drive to catch Bet Twice ahead of the wire. Also won the Preakness as well. You heard the name of Gary Stevens at the beginning, and this is something that I have no audience for other than this podcast, that just the observation that Gary Stevens, he was in the movie Seabiscuit way back when. I want to say it was like 2004 or whatever. He kind of reminded me in that movie of Dean Malenko on a number of different levels. So yeah, that kind of observation would not have much of an audience elsewhere. So Jim Ross is our host, and we're going to trot through guest color guys, at least until the next taping, when Magnum TA will be joining him, which is good to keep him working. They're familiar with him from the territory. But one change that has been made is that JR is now down at ringside, and that is one of those Jim Crockett Promotions things that they had instituted. And sure enough, alongside him is a very strange man. Yes, our old pal, John Ayers, who you might remember from Jim Crockett Promotions 1988, where he served as the commissioner in the fall, around the time of Clash of the Champions 3. He had a confrontation with J.J. Dillon around that time. And he's not exactly the most excitable guy in the world. His full name is actually John Milton Ayers. So it's very hard to be more boring than Milton.
Don't write this down, but I find Milton probably as boring as you find Milton. Mrs. Milton found him boring, too. He's a little bit long-winded. He doesn't translate very well into our generation, and his jokes are terrible.
We'll hear from John Milton Ayers in just a second, but to just provide a little bit of background on who this guy is, yes, he's a football player, and he was active in the NFL at that time, played left guard for the San Francisco 49ers. So he did win two Super Bowls in 1981 and 1984. And he was okay. I mean, he was on one of the best teams in the league, so there's a certain notoriety that comes with it. But when they say, oh, he was an all-pro or whatever, I mean, he made all-conference once in 1984, which may have had something to do with the fact that that 49ers team is one of the 5 to 10 best teams in NFL history. Kind of forgotten compared with other 49ers teams, because it was before Jerry Rice got there, but they were still very good. This is around the time that the 49ers got rid of him. He lands with the Broncos for one final season. But he played his college ball at West Texas, which gives him something in common with a lot of guys in professional wrestling. Ted DiBiase, Terry Blanchard, just to name a few of those guys. And also a dear friend, John Ayers, is of Terry Funk, something I learned in my research on him a couple of years ago. But why do they need to get a commissioner now? Like, why can't you just have it be like a faceless thing off screen? Or, you know, maybe just wait for the right person to come along. And the sign of that things aren't necessarily good is that Jim Ross is doing all the talking at this point, where it seems like he might be trying to conceal something, that maybe John Ayers isn't the most charismatic talker. Now, I will say that Jack Tunney is not exactly a barrel of charisma either. But generally, they would just have him sit behind a desk and read a teleprompter, which, you know, you can seem a little bit stilted when you're doing that. You're kind of the authority figure. It's like a message from the White House. Instead, they got Ayers standing up against the ring apron, listening to JR, and he's got a riff.
I think the one-man gang's always outweighed everybody by 250, 350 pounds. And this is the first time we went out and found somebody that's his size and stature, you know, and give him a real test.
I'm not joking. This is my job.
So if you've been watching the UWF for a period of time, you know that they have these top 10 contenders to the title, and now all of a sudden, here's this person that you've literally never seen before, unless you were watching TBS, which you may have some familiarity with the Saturday Night Show on TBS, and you've seen Big Bubba Rogers, and I don't know if Starcade had, you know, closed captioning out in Oklahoma, or whatever. But it's just so weird that you portray, oh, well, you have to fight your way up the top 10. But all of a sudden, this guy is able to walk in and get a shot at the title, which is one of the big flaws of what we're presenting here. This is the first time he's on TV, although I thought he might have been on Power Pro, but not the week before, maybe the same weekend. Who knows? As far as I can tell, this is the first time that he's on UWF TV. So, you know, I guess Ayers made a little bit of sense. Maybe I shouldn't have played the Spanish Flea music underneath of it, but yeah, I wanted to see if he was actually watching the product. But he did provide a logical thing where, well, we got to have a big guy as the challenger for the very large champion. But don't forget as well, the one-man gang, they got to get the title off him because he's not signed to a contract. And if he's not signing a contract, he could just go somewhere, and they got to get the title off him immediately. And sure enough, he shows up in the WWF at a taping 10 days after this show airs on TV. And he's on Superstars 3 weeks after this point. So they wasted no time because they're coming off Hogan and Andre at WrestleMania 3. Where do you go from there? Well, you got to get a different fat guy in there. And sure enough, One Man Gang is facing Hogan on house shows at various points later in the year. So while I might not think very much of John Ayers as a color commentator, and he stays down there at least for the opening match, Eddie Gilbert, the television champion, is there to save us. And you wonder, well, if he's the number one contender, why doesn't he get the shot at the One Man Gang? Well, funny thing about that, it was a couple of weeks before this where there was a match scheduled with Eddie Gilbert and the One Man Gang, and Ken Mantell alluded to this on the prior week's show that I covered last week, where it was canceled. And the reason for that cancellation was pretty classic in that Eddie claimed to have had an injury that required 24 hours to heal, but it had only been 22 hours since the doctor had said 24 hours, so he still needed a couple of more hours, so he was going to be unable to go. This is part of like a weird series of things where the Buzz Sawyer one-man gang thing that was the intro to last week's show, that match never actually took place. It was a forfeit where the gang forfeited the match or something, but it's unclear why the gang didn't give up the title, because he actually won the UWF title via forfeit from Terry Gordy in late 1986. So, a head scratcher on that, but hey, you know, those type of things happen with promotions where things are going downhill, even if the TV is still good overall. So Eddie Gilbert is just swooping in to give us 30 seconds of good mic time.
Jim Ross, my thoughts on this match right here. Everybody's talking about a super fight and a super match in wrestling. Well, sir, I got to shake your hands for putting this match together, because we all know about the one-man gang, how bad he is, how big he is. I'll tell you right now, Jim Ross, I'm nervous for both men. And for Big Bubba Rogers, where he's from, with Jim Cornette, everything. I went back and tried to shake his hand to wish him luck. He wouldn't even talk to me. I'm waiting to see this showdown.
I'm not sure how much of that was mic'd to the crowd, because when Big Bubba comes out, he actually gets a very positive reaction. Now, he's not coming out with a manager. There's no Akbar. Jim Cornette isn't there, even though his name was invoked by Eddie Gilbert. So it's kind of, he's the de facto babyface, because the gang has been this monster heel champion for so long that they're just dying to see anybody take the title off him. And it doesn't really matter if it's a dude that they literally met like 5 minutes before. So we get an ad break, and during this, apparently, it's all the national commercials, because they're actually left in place. Alka-Seltzer, OxyClean, and yes, I was shocked that an Acne product found its way onto a wrestling program. And for Monroe, Shocks and Struts. I'll just bypass that, because I really want to talk about this match, because it's a pretty long one between the one-man gang and Big Bubba Rogers. Yes. The Proto Twin Towers collide in 1987 UWF. And those two guys are linked at so many different ways. You got this match here, which is, you know, kind of a moment in wrestling history, as we'll see. They have a WrestleMania match with each other 3 years down the road at WrestleMania 6 that doesn't really get a lot of time. Because you have the angle on the outside with DiBiase and the Boss Man before the match even starts, and I think it gets cut down to make sure that they had enough time for Hogan and Warrior at the end. And then, of course, the tag team, the Twin Towers, in early 1989, in the main event, as the Mega Powers explode. Now, as Jim Ross points out, there's no Skandor Akbar with the One Man Gang, which is rather interesting, considering that he's the freaking world champion, and he's had this manager with him for his entire time in the UWF. But since we don't have a good color guy in John Milton Ayers, we have a third guy in the booth. And is it Eddie Gilbert? Oh, no, no. Why would we want to have somebody who can actually talk instead? God help us, we got Dr. Death Steve Williams.
Hey, it's great to be here, Jim Ross. Exciting place, Muskogee, Oklahoma, boy. The roof's shaking, the floor's shaking, everything's happening right here. I can feel it.
I'm not saying that Dr. Death is in the bag here, but the way his voice sounds kind of reminds me, or at least what I picture Jim Duggan sounding like when he got pulled over by the Jersey State Police with the Iron Sheik in the car as well, also in May of 1987. As the introductions are wrapping up and we finally could get underway with this, Jim Ross just annoys me by doing this one thing.
This match, one fall or television time remaining. This match, one fall or television time remaining.
It's an entirely different kind of flying altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
I mean, I kind of want to yell, he just said that, you fat bleep, but I really don't. You know, I should just get to the freaking match. But then JR says that John Ayers and Dr. Death Steve Williams, two of the greatest football players ever to play the game. Now, I'm wondering, where did they finish in the Heisman Trophy balloting, Jim? I know you're very fond of Ron Simmons. Of course, that wouldn't be until much later. So why don't I just get to it? One Man Gang and Bubba, two big dudes. And they lock up and they go around the ring, kind of, you know, not quite to all four corners. And you get a one-man gang shoulder block, establishing that he's not going to be able to move Big Bubba, even though he does have a pretty significant weight advantage. I mean, Big Bubba is in the mid-300s. Gang's mid-400s, but they bill him at 500 because it makes it seem more imposing. The gang tries for a body slam and can't get it. And as Jim Ross points out, that Bubba is the bodyguard for Jim Cornette and also a mercenary for J.J. Dillon, which I thought was interesting. I don't really remember his work on that as much prior to that point. Of course, Big Bubba would be the fill-in for J.J. Dillon in the second War Games match in the summer of 87 because Dillon got hurt himself in the first War Games match. So Gang actually is shoved off on the body slam try, and Bubba tries for one of his own, which seems ridiculous because Gang's even bigger than him, and he can't get it. And this is such a unique match when, in terms, not just because it's two huge dudes, I mean, that's commonplace through history, but two large heels going at it with stakes this high. I don't think there's really any other match quite like this. And if there is, please direct me to it because I want to watch all matches of this type. Although you're probably not going to see certain things that happen later in this match in the modern era. Reversal of a corner whip. Bubba misses a charge into the corner and kind of does the Sergeant Slaughter bump over the top rope. And he hits the guardrail on the way down. And sure enough, I see him, you know, maneuver his hand towards his face. And yes, we get a blade job less than 3 minutes into this freaking match. That's how you know that Jim Crockett is in charge of this. It's like, the guy who ran Starrcade 85 is here, everybody. So we're going to bleed all over the... Well, I was going to say the Irish McNeil Boys Club, but they've long since abandoned that place. As Gang goes out there, sends him into the rail as well. The blade job might have occurred on the second one into the rail. It may not have been when he fell out of the ring. Five right hands and then an exchange of punches back inside. A forearm by Big Bubba finally floors the Gang, and he sets the Gang's neck on the top rope and comes off the second rope looking to kind of clothesline him. And Bubba actually misses, clotheslines himself on the top rope, so Gang goes for a pinfall, but only gets a one count, and the kick out was so powerful that the Gang ends up falling all the way to the outside. So rather unusual to see that for a man of that carriage. Gang grabs a foot, but this allows Bubba to show off his uncommon agility for a guy of that size. And Enziguri, like, picture yourself in the shoes of a wrestling fan in 1987 and a 370-pound guy, or whatever the hell they were billing Bubba as, doing an Enziguri. He's fatter here than he was as the Big Boss Man, I think. And he was billed at 357 when he came into the WWF, and I would maybe put him a little bit higher than that. They go back outside the ring. There's a table there, which I'm kind of excited. Like, are they actually going to do a table spot? But that was just kind of a false flag. Gang is sent face first into it. And now I see him maneuvering in a certain way. And yes, the one-man gang is now bleeding. We get double juice 6 or 7 minutes into the first Jim Crockett promoted match in the UWF. It's so insane. It's so great, though, I have to say. But back inside, a commercial cuts off the action. So this is kind of an interesting way of going about it. Yeah, we got both guys bleeding, two guys going at it, tooth and nail, as hard as they can, two huge dudes, but we got to go to commercial. And then when we come back from commercial, we get a promo with Chris Adams and Terry Taylor, which I cannot think of a weirder way to place this within the show, especially since later in the show, you get an Adams and Taylor match and then a promo after that match. But I guess they want to review the tag team title loss from the Omni in the month of April. I kind of got ahead of myself last week, and I think that's a habit of mine where I'm not used to doing back-to-back shows of a single promotion, so I just kind of, you know, referred to something that wasn't necessarily shown on TV until the following week. So better days ahead for these two guys? Who knows? But it's not for us, because we get to hear the annoying voice, the ever-annoying voice of Terry Taylor first.
Yeah, I think so. You can't dwell on the past, though, Jim. It was a bad, bad night. And I don't hold it against you, Chris, that you got pinned. I mean, it happens to everybody. But the way it happened, those two guys always out there, and there's always something going on. But Chris and I have been talking about it. I don't think there's a whole lot of bad blood, but we could do it again if we decided we won't. Go ahead.
No, you're right. But I was going to ask you a question, you see, because we have been tag team partners for a long time.
Yes, sir.
And successful. Thank you very much. And we've always looked after each other's back.
Right.
And we've always looked after each other's interests. Okay? So I figure, you know, I still don't know why we lost. And I think that we ought to get down to the nitty gritty and go over the match and see exactly what happened. For example, you know, when you lose grip, you start to slide, and I don't want that to happen to me and you, Terry.
Oh, no, no, it's just a bad night, Chris. You know, that could happen to anybody. We just had a little bad luck. I don't hold it against you. Please don't make it look like it's like,
I realize that, but let's go over the match. What happened in
I
the
think
match?
It's in the past a little bit. I'm not trying to be a little hateful or anything, but it's in the past. We had to move forward. You can't keep looking back. Remember, we have beaten past it for beating men. We have to move forward.
But you are going to move forward in the tag team competition, quite obviously, right?
Sure. Well, remember we were talking in the car a little bit, and we said something about a little bit of singles and a little bit of tag. I mean, you have to spice it up a little bit. Remember in the car you told me that?
There's just something about his voice that bugs me, so I'm going to play the Red Rooster theme in the background, because at least some, you know, happy synthesizer music will make things a little bit better. And also, Chris Adams being there makes it tolerable. I love the way he says nitty-gritty. Like, I will never get tired of English people saying nitty-gritty. Please incorporate that into everything you say from now on. It's, the way that Chris Adams said it is just so great. So we're setting up, clearly, a heel turn by Terry Taylor. And there's going to be more on that later in the show. But that car accident in June really kind of derailed it. And, I mean, this is one of the better things that the UWF had from a carryover perspective, simply because you had two guys who were actually planning to stay there, even though Adams, as I said, ends up back in world class, because I don't think JCP really wanted him around. Gotta say, though, with Taylor's car accident, really a bad time for wrestlers to be in cars in that springtime of 1987. They go to an ad break, and when they come back to the Big Bubba versus One Man Gang match, General Akbar has now made his way to the ring. Like, what the hell's going on here? And he actually distracts the gang for a brief second, and the crowd is very much behind Big Bubba. There should be no mistaking that. No matter how many times you reference Jim Cornette or whatever. Gang is kind of teetering at this point, so Bubba goes for a pin, get a foot on the ropes by the gang, and then he does that thing that he would do as Akeem as well, where he kind of gets trapped in the ropes. Not the full Andre thing, although he eventually does fall back and get his arms tied in the ropes in that same style, but where he's just kind of sitting awkwardly on the second rope in the middle of the ring and kind of in a position where, like, if you're sitting in a Lafuma chair or in a hammock and you really just have trouble getting out of it, that's kind of the best way to describe what One Man Gang is doing. As a headbutt actually hurts both guys, and then Gang gets feet up in the corner to knock Bubba back and just kind of give himself a little bit of room. I'm also thinking about the One Man Gang blading in this match. Like, why would he do this? Considering that if it isn't his last match in the UWF, and I think he might have one more match after this just on a house show, why would you do it? Just for an enhanced payoff? I'm not entirely sure that was on the table. I mean, dude, you're walking out the door. You're going to the WWF. Like, don't cut your freaking forehead for these guys that aren't going to be paying you in a few weeks. You're off to make big money. So I'm kind of scratching my head on that. I mean, I'm not going to lay in judgment of, like, the quote-unquote, the barbaric practice of blading. It's that I don't see the point of why he would do that just from a human being level, like why he would agree to it. I mean, yeah, he's doing business. He's losing the title on the way out, but why does he have to juice as well? As JR talks about how everyone wants a shot at the UWF heavyweight title. Like, thanks, Jim, for pointing that out, and how this guy who just walked in the door is able to get the shot when, you know, you maintain a top 10 list. So that's the thing that confuses me the most. As we get a slugfest in the center of the ring and a big clothesline by the gang, and he drops an elbow, and this sets up a 747 splash attempt off the second rope, but that misses. So now Bubba takes advantage. He goes up to the top rope, hits a big splash. Not his greatest work in the world. I mean, yes, he's a big dude, because he kind of lands on his feet, which they expose by doing a slow motion replay of it later. Probably not the best use of instant replay in wrestling, to slow-mo a move that doesn't look good when you slow it down. But that is enough to pick up the 1-2-3. And the crowd cheers, because the evil One Man Gang, who had held this title for about 6 months, I think a little over 6 months, might have been 5 months at this point, they cheer wildly, but not as much as they would have if Dr. Death or Ted DiBiase or one of the old favorites had won the title. So you think, okay, great reaction for this new guy, but they have different plans for him going forward, which we're going to see in, well, a couple of segments later in the show.
And leaves Sting and Adams in, but Eddie Gilbert on the outside of the ring with the UWF Tag Team title belt, and Chris Adams reverses it, firing Sting's head into the turnbuckle. Eddie Gilbert's plan backfired. Oh, man! Adams just about had the three count as Edwin Falk signals a two count. Adams pounding his head on the mat. It looks like Adams is planning his next move. Could it be the super kick? Sting getting up very slowly. It looks like Adams is setting for it. Here it comes. If he connects, and he does! Man, he just about took Sting's head off. Eddie Gilbert trying to revive Sting on the outside of the ring.
but Sting has got to be out. Oh, it looks like Sting is lacerated. He is in bad, bad shape. Eddie Gilbert's just standing there. What's he doing? Oh, man, he took the ankle of Chris Adams while Edward Falk was distracted by Taylor and Steiner on the outside of the ring. Edward Falk down for the count. Sting hooks the leg and secures the three count. Terry Taylor on the outside of the ring, still fighting with Steiner. He thinks they won the match. He was distracted just like Falk was.
Well, that was a poor play-by-play dub over of the tag team title change from the Omni back in April. It kind of sounds like Joel Wants, but I don't know if it's him. Whoever it is, it just sounds like that they are reading stuff off paper. Like if I was reading my notes, review of tag title change, foot kicked off rope. I mean, I kind of went over what happened, but really just kind of a bad job. Like, what the hell is going on here? But I guess you got to make it clear and what they have going forward and how. I mean, you have the film of it, so you might as well do it. Of course, that takes place after the sale, so you get the titles off Adams and Taylor, put it on Sting and Rick Steiner, who are UWF guys, but we will see them. They're basically mainstays of WCW for the entire time that that promotion exists, JCP into WCW, the only exception being when Rick Steiner splits for the WWF, and even that only lasts less than 18 months, and Sting, of course, a lifer to the very end. And this all leads into the tag team match, Chris Adams and Terry Taylor taking on the Red Devil and Bob Bradley. So Bob Bradley was a guy who would get around in various territories as an enhancement guy. As to the Red Devil, who is a masked man, that is actually Ken Massey, who is a veteran enhancement guy in the UWF and also other places as well. You must wonder, why doesn't he just wrestle as Ken Massey? Why does he have to wrestle as the Red Devil also?
I get two paychecks this way.
Bradley starts the match against Adams and misses a clothesline, and then Adams answers with a crossbody where it looked like Bradley was not expecting it. It was definitely kind of awkward. Like, it ends up in a two count and followed up with a dropkick by Chris Adams. And he's thrown back in from the ring apron as Bradley kind of bailed to the outside. Taylor in there, and they hit a double back elbow, and oh, it's so nice to have the back elbow back in my life after, I think, a 2-week hiatus after I noticed that it's very much overused in older wrestling programs. It's just been too long. I mean, it's a nice simple thing, though, because it allows me time to write it down. I probably have a proper abbreviation for that. The Red Devil, like, how do you come up with a name like that? Like, is he named after a vacuum cleaner because he sucks? Because I know, like, the Dirt Devils are red, and they're commonly known as the Red Devils. I'm just saying. So they say, Jim Ross, oh, he's got an unorthodox style. Like, okay, yeah, that's just wonderful. I've only been seeing him lose on TV for quite some time now. And with Terry Taylor in there, you got the Red Devil and the Red Rooster. So it's two red guys and a corner whip by the Red Devil, but it's the SC Jones Memorial Charge. He misses. Taylor hits a vertical suplex, tags out to Chris Adams, who starts working the left arm, body slam and a knee drop, followed up, gets a two count, follows up with a clothesline, but then misses a knee. I'm like, what's going on here? Yeah, Chris Adams constantly battling the devil. It is some sort of metaphor for his life at large, but he does hit the super kick. And Terry Taylor tags himself in. Even though Adams has hit his finisher, we kind of got to make the point that Terry Taylor is a dick. So he tags himself in, hits a well-measured knee drop, and that is how they pick up the three count. And as it turns out, this would be the final match for these two guys on television for reasons that I'll get into later.
Ice cream is crunches.
Ice cream?
When it crunches.
Ice cream.
That's why I love Nestle Crunch.
Nestle Crunch ice cream bars are scrunchious.
That's why we love Nestle Crunch.
I'm sure this has come up before with Nestle Crunch. It feels like it was a much bigger deal in the 80s. Like, they poured a lot more into advertising. And then by, like, the year 2000, you never heard about it anymore. Like, I can't remember the last time I even wanted one of those things. And I'm not sure why that just faded out so much. I'm not sure why I'm even talking about it other than the fact that the ad aired, but yeah, we got another Terry Taylor Chris Adams promo where they're at ringside after their match, And I just think to myself, Taylor Adams or Adam Taylor, if you like mixed up their names, they sound like pretty good teen idol names. But instead, we're once again stuck with Terry Taylor. And Jim Ross has some questions. And who gets to talk first? Is it the guy whose voice that I absolutely hate? Or is it the guy with the pleasant British accent who said nitty-gritty earlier? I think we all know what the answer is.
There's a lot of questions to be answered. I'm not upset with Chris about losing. It's okay. We're a great team, but I think that's in the past. In professional wrestling, sometimes, Chris, like you told me in the car, a lot of times, sometimes you got to go your own way.
Can I just intervene here, please, Jim? The fact is, you know, when you lose your grip, you start to slide. And I think that Terry and I make a fantastic tag team, and I'd like to talk more about where a mistake was at that particular point in time, if you don't mind, Terry. Because I feel if we can point the problem that happened there in the Omni, then we can sort a few things out. Because, you know, we look after each other's back. We get on well as a tag team. We were the champions for a long time.
You're right. We were. We were a great team. You're right. That's water under the bridge, I think. Like you said, Jim, you told me behind closed doors that you thought we were a great tag team. Sometimes you have to leave what's behind you behind. I'm not losing my grip, brother. It's just time to move on. I think you guys are pushing me a little bit on it. I think I've made up my mind. I've made my point clear. Jim, nice seeing you. Hi, everybody. Maybe some other...
All right, the douchey part at the end, which I have to separate from the douchey part of everything else that Terry Taylor was saying, where he just kind of taps Jim Ross on the shoulder like, nice to see you, gotta get out of here, gotta go, bye, and just sort of walks off. He's just lucky that Chris Adams wasn't actually drinking at the time, or he probably would have gouged out his eyeballs and skull-f***ed him, quite frankly. I mean, this is a man who headbutted a pilot on a freaking plane that he was on. And I understand, Adams, he's trying to redeem himself, he's going to be nice here, I guess until it's time to not be nice, but he headbutted a pilot. I don't understand, like, how does Skylaw get invoked in that? That might be something to explore for another time. So it's next week's show on the May 9th edition, where these two guys face off, and it just kind of feels very much out of nowhere as well, kind of like Big Bubba challenging for the UWF title. They were number 9 and number 10 in the rankings on the previous week. So the thought was, well, whoever wins is going to, you know, climb the ladder towards getting a title shot. And Adams ends up winning it by a countout, but he refuses to accept that as a legitimate means of victory and says, okay, we're going to do a rematch the following week. And they do on the May 16th show, and Taylor wins that one by countout when he decided to channel King Slender from the Nintendo game Pro Wrestling and hit a freaking pile driver on the floor and leave Adams for dead out there and say, you know what, I will accept a countout victory. So, you know, another douchey move from the future Red Rooster. But, you know, sometimes they say that the best characters are the real person turned up to 11. Like, Terry Taylor being a douchebag. It's basically him. Okay, it's just that they've, you know, dialed back the racism.
The rookie sensation, Steve Cox, a local favorite in the Universal Wrestling Federation because he really earned his athletic reputation with the University of Tulsa playing football for the Golden Hurricane.
I swear, trying to fact check some of Jim Ross's football stuff can be exhausting, although this one was kind of funny. In Steve Cox, the rookie sensation, which the antenna goes up on that as well whenever somebody is a rookie sensation. That was Steve Travis in the WWF in 1979. If he could get together with Steve Cox from the UWF in 1987 and Buff Bagwell or Marcus Alexander Bagwell from 1992, they could all have a triple threat match or a four-way dance with Kurt Angle from 2000 where he just suplexes the living crap out of every single one of them. But back to the Steve Cox football thing. He says he played football at the University of Tulsa. Okay, well, that's vague enough, but you can find stats on guys. However, when you look up Steve Cox, University of Tulsa, there is a guy who played for them. He was not the captain of the team, as Cox's Wikipedia claims, but rather the kicker slash punter for the University of Tulsa. So I don't think it's the same guy, especially considering that the kicker-punter guy was good enough to make the NFL play 4 years for the Browns, play 4 years in Washington, and be part of a Super Bowl team that won Super Bowl 22 over the Denver Broncos. Yes, Steve Cox was the punter on that team, but it's not this Steve Cox, even though they both apparently played football at the University of Tulsa. But I could not find anything having to do with this Steve Cox playing football for whatever reason. So now that I've tied myself in knots, he's actually taking on the Super Ninja. I don't know why I said it that way. But Super Ninja I went into last week as the guy who wore a friggin' swastika on his hands when he was in the AWA shortly after this. This is actually Shinji Takano, who was born in Japan to a Japanese woman and an African-American Marine. Unfortunately, he split. He didn't really want to hang around there. I guess he probably wanted to come back to the United States. And Takano, he went from New Japan to All Japan in 84 and then came over to the States on a learning excursion in 86. This is a part of that. And where he would go would be the AWA here in the UWF, and would also make his way up to Portland in the middle of 1987. I've actually never seen Portland TV from that time. If you wonder, why did you do that one show from 1980 and you haven't done any other Portland shows? Like, there's hardly anything else out there. It's like, I found a bunch of 1980 Portland TV that's under an hour, and outside of that, it's all either an hour and a half long or it's, you know, or maybe even the video quality is bad. I can't remember. But Takano was interesting to go back to him. 1988 Real World Tag League partner over in Japan was John Tenta. And they ended up finishing ninth. So Tenta, about a year before he enters the WWF. Cox is 27 years old at this point. So he's actually about the same age as the punter, which made it even more confusing. He winds up as Michael Hayes' pal in World Class in early 1988 when Hayes had kind of split apart from the Freebirds for a little bit. Turns up in Global in 1991 and also ends up in 92 in the work shoot promotion UWFI, which made me wonder, how many guys are there that worked both the Watts UWF and UWFI, or even the Herb Abrams UWF and UWFI? And I say that because Dr. Death Steve Williams did the Abrams and Watts versions of the UWF, and I think there might be more crossover just because it's in the same country. I don't know. It's just a weird thing about Steve Cox, who gets worked over a little bit early as Super Ninja hits a double underhook suplex. I'm like, wow, is this guy going to actually win one? We get a sunset flip for two by Cox, and then a flat. Right after this, he follows it up with a flash Russian leg sweep, which, by the way, I swear to God that Jim Ross calls it a suplex, and that is how he picks up the three count. I really don't know what to say about this, but it is pretty embarrassing that Jim Ross, a guy who, oh, Jim Ross is legendary announcer, like, did not know what a Russian leg sweep was in 1987.
Cox didn't quite have him set. Steve Cox now with a side suplex. Cox floating over. Great fight in the leg. One, two, and three.
So this, at least they didn't waste my time. They got that match over with quick so we could move on to something hopefully fresh that I can talk about. And, oh crap, it's Gary Young and Chavo Guerrero, a recap of their feud, which I covered last week. See, this is why I don't do the same show 2 weeks in a row, because now I gotta figure out a take on this feud where Gary Young stole $39,000 from Chavo. It must have been some prize, or who knows what it is, an insurance payment. I have absolutely no idea. So they flashback 2 weeks previous, where Gary Young's taking on Jeff Rates on Power Pro Wrestling, which I think would be the other show. I'm not entirely sure. But some mild heel tactics by Gary Young, but then Rates fires up with a drop kick. And in running the ropes, the friggin' ref just runs in the middle of what's going on. Like, they missed him at first, like almost like they just missed the spot, and referee Carl Fergie just kind of runs in and gets clobbered, which nothing bothers me quite like bad ref bumps or just bad officiating in general. I don't know if you've noticed, but if you followed on my Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, I have gone chapter and verse at how Earl Hebner is a horrible official. And a lot of these have been demonstrated because, you know, the OVP podcast has been posting a lot of clips. And earlier this week, there was the clip at the end of WrestleMania 6 where the Warrior and Hogan, Hogan's going to hand off the belt to Warrior and have that moment with him. Well, stupid Earl Hebner grabs the freaking belt and hands it to the Warrior, who has to hand it back to Hebner. Now, Hogan is outside the ring. He grabs the belt and he goes on as planned to hand Warrior the belt. Hebner stands in the freaking ring the entire time as if anybody gives a rat's ass about him. Like, only Earl Hebner would make that moment about Earl Hebner. He completely sucks and he's a complete fraud. And quite frankly, I'm glad he got fired. I just wish that he had been fired some 15, 20 years before that, so I never have to tolerate any of these horrible ref bumps that he's done over the years. In watching WrestleMania X7 last week, I saw non-Earl Hebner ref bumps, and they actually did their job well. Jack Doan, I think, I don't know if Kyoto, whoever it was, but they were done a hell of a lot better than the stupid Earl Hebner ones. Anyway, this is a lot more fresh than Gary Young and Chavo Guerrero, I can assure you. All I care about, you know, there's only a few things. Like, look, I don't consider myself an influencer by any means here. In fact, I hate that freaking term. But please, if I have to have like a tombstone for my podcasting career, it would be, here lies Peter Winston. He convinced everybody that Earl Hebner really sucked as a referee, and that got over with everybody. So anyway, Jeff Rates gets run into the ring post and with the referee down. You hit a knee off the top, which I guess technically, since this was 2 weeks before, Watts is still in charge, so that top rope rule is still in effect. But when he goes for the cover, he stupidly goes for the cover even though he can see that the ref is down, because he just puts himself in a vulnerable position, because Chavo walks down and hits a very mild elbow. It's not like he came flying off the top rope onto him. And this allows Jeff Rates to pick up the three count, even though Gary Young kicked out. So some pretty poor officiating. Who knows? Maybe you could just blame it on him being woozy. So we go to another match, which is from the previous week, Chavo versus the Super Ninja. They're slugging it out. We get another ref bump. And I'm wondering what the hell's going on, but then I remembered, oh yeah, this is the last days of Rome. I don't mean that literally. Of course, this might actually be the last days of Rome, like right now with the coronavirus, having seen some of the things. But you know, the old guy, the guy in charge, he's going to be out soon. So we're going to just do ref bumps in every match. Belly to back suplex. So now Gary Young makes his way down and tries to do the same thing to Chavo, except Chavo gets out of the way. And Chavo just ends up picking up the three count that way when the ref comes to. So why am I supposed to care about this? I don't quite understand why I'm supposed to care about this feud. I mean, clearly Chavo has outsmarted him at a couple of different turns. What? Because Gary Young is holding $39,000, which is $88,000 in today's money. I've already gone over what the hell I would do with that kind of money. But Chavo is in the next match. It's against Mike Boyette, who is now 0-16. And it doesn't look good for him going forward. But then again, they let Hugh Jackson coach the Cleveland Browns for two full seasons, and he won one game. So I guess it's not the worst of all time. Boyette grabs the hair to try and gain advantage, but he's absolutely no follow-through. Like, I don't know what exactly is up with him. We get an arm drag, and Boyette is, he gets on a head scissors, but Chavo is able to get out of it pretty quickly. And I'm just wondering why the hell I'm supposed to care. I know Chavo is winding up here, and you know, this is pretty much the end of his career as a full-time entity. Of course he would come back as Chavo Classic. But let me just think about the Guerrero family and wrestling families. I should probably watch the WWE Legends of Wrestling thing. I have not watched those in many years on the network. When they first were put on there, I was watching those like back to back to back all the time in the first year that I had the network. But great families in wrestling. The Guerreros, now I haven't given much thought to where any particular family would rank. I mean, you have three generations of Ortons, but I'm thinking in terms of guys who were around at the same time. So you had Eddie's a little bit later than some of the other Guerreros of his generation. You have the Von Erichs, but you kind of cut that off after the end of 1983 because David dies, and then you got all the other stuff after that. The Hart family, well, obviously plenty of tragedy there, but you got Owen and Brett pretty much hitting their peak at the same time. So I kind of give them the edge. Plus, you have those ancillary guys like Davey Boy Smith to add on. But I'd love a Survivor Series match between the members of the Hart family and members of the Guerrero family. If I could get that in a time machine, I would really, really enjoy that. But what is funny is when they go into the commercial, there's an ad for that laser watch again that I talked about last week. And all that did was make me think of Lasertron, who was portrayed in the NWA during 1987 by none other than Hector Guerrero. We must live while we can, and we drink our cup of laughter. The sun and things keep shining through, the way my soul gets lost in you. The sun and things are feeling me, the golden dance by good and me. Finer Things by Steve Winwood. Probably my favorite song by him was in the top 40, actually top half of the top 40 on that week in 1987. And it's only appropriate that I play my favorite Winwood song. It's my favorite guy from the UWF is out here to save us for at least 2 minutes. And that is, of course, Thomas Edward Eddie Gilbert, who always good for at least 2 minutes of this show to save us from the Jeff Rateses and the Terry Taylors and all that sort of stuff. Although I do question his gear a little bit. He had actually a wider wardrobe than a lot of guys at that time, but I don't know why he's wearing suspenders.
Pretty cool way to keep your pants up, eh?
All right, well, I stand corrected. But it is interesting to get the thoughts from the television champion on this guy swooping into town, becoming the UWF champion, just kind of over everybody's heads, just see what his feelings are on it. And, oh yeah, he drops one bomb in there kind of by accident.
What is your assessment of Big Bubba Rogers and what's going on with General Skandar Akbar behind the scenes?
Well, at first, Jill, I tell you, right when you said new and the UWF World's Heavyweight Champion, I have still got goosebumps all over my body because I would love if someday to be in that position to stand here and say that I am the UWF World's Heavyweight Champion or even be associated with somebody that's the World's Heavyweight Champion. And somehow or another, out of nowhere, here comes Big Bubba Rogers into the UWF and becomes, in just less than, say, 15 minutes, becomes the World's Heavyweight Champion. Everybody's dream come true. And because of one man. And how can that always happen? Because of Skandar Akbar, and somehow or another, he leads one man to the title, and when he sees that he's getting a little dusty, a little rough under the edges, he brings in the young guys.
What a great job by the production team on this show to clearly air stuff out of order and spoil your big reveal that's coming up later when Akbar is with Big Bubba in the dressing room. Like, that should be your reveal, not Jim Ross, you know, just casually dropping it into a conversation with Eddie Gilbert, and that's how we find out what's going on here. It's pretty insane. It's kind of like if you're watching the Dallas in 1980 and the Who Shot JR, and you get one of those news updates where, you know, the newscaster will come on and be like, tonight at 11, blah, 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 and he says, tonight at 11, we get people's reaction to Kristen Shepherd shooting JR, and it occurs 10 minutes before the big reveal would have happened on Dallas. That's what this is like. Maybe not to that extent, because clearly not as many people are watching this or really care at this point, but nice job, assholes, spoiling your own angles in the reveal on your own show. Like, how hard is it to do that? Like, it's not even the era of social media where that stuff is commonplace with trolls. It's just, you have to hit yourself in the forehead. Basically, it's that Captain Picard meme where he just has his head in his face. Like, what the hell are we doing here? Why are we just dropping this in the middle of the show where it's not supposed to be? Why don't we just go into the final match, for God's sake? It's a crawl to the finish line here on UWF TV. But thankfully, it's the new tag team champions, Sting and Rick Steiner, taking on Jeff Rates and Mike Reed. So Rates gets two matches, I guess, on this week's show. Kind of like how Boyette, we saw him a couple of times on last week's show. We start out with Sting and Mike Reed. Sting just kind of beats his ass. He's still pretty rudimentary at this point. Not even close to the Sting that you would see less than a year later. It's funny to watch him here and be like, okay, this is April of 1987 when this is taped. 11 months from now, he's going to have the match with Flair at the Clash of the Champions. It's just so crazy how far he came in such a short period of time. He tags out to Rick. And I would argue that if you take every guy who is on this show, and you could make a case maybe for One Man Gang or Big Bubba Rogers or hell, even Dr. Death Steve Williams, although he's really only on commentary, that the two biggest stars in this show are Sting and Rick Steiner if you take their career as a whole. Like, it kind of makes me wonder, who's a bigger star? The Big Boss Man in WWF and all that Ray Traylor did, or Rick Steiner? I'd probably have to go with Rick Steiner just on the basis of he's in one of the greatest tag teams of all time. And for all my talk about Sting still kind of finding his way at this point, Rick Steiner is still pretty young as well. There was a Steiner line. I thought it was a Steiner line, but it might have just been a shoulder block. I really couldn't tell. It was not a good camera angle. And he tosses the man into the corner, tosses Reed over so he can tag Jeff Raitt in, so we know who's eating the pin in this one. And he kind of is thrown into a clothesline off the top rope, get an elbow with Sting holding Raitt in the body vice position, and that is how they end up picking up the victory, Sting and Rick Steiner. I don't really see them on the UWF quite as much in the episodes that I watched after this, but if I were to undertake a 1987 UWF watch, similar to my 1984 WWF watch that I did back in the summer of 2016, that almost was like the genesis of this program, be interested to see how those two guys evolve in that period before they get fully integrated into the Crockett Show, before they start turning up in Techwood Studios, because Sting doesn't have any matches there until at least October.
The Universal Wrestling Federation Training Center is open. Never in the history of professional wrestling has the general public been offered the opportunity to actually become a superstar. If you've ever even dreamed of being a wrestler, manager, or valet, the UWF Training Center is where your road to superstardom begins. You'll learn the ins and outs from the pros themselves. You'll train with the champions as you prepare for the glamour, the excitement, the prestige, and the million-dollar contracts that are the professional wrestling. The response to our star search has been overwhelming, and the immediate success of the students in our very first session clearly shows that the stars of the future will all come from the UWF Training Center. The chance of a lifetime is yours for the asking. We'll give you the key that unlocks the door to a career in pro wrestling. For details, simply write UWF Training Center, P.O. Box 815-099, Dallas. That's UWF, P.O. Box 815-099, Dallas. The star search is on. Come join us now.
The only thing I wish I had out of that commercial is when the guy says million-dollar contracts. Oh, I wish that Ted DiBiase was on screen when he said that, because that would have been so great. Unfortunately, DiBiase is in another part of the commercial lifting weights with Dr. Death. So you're going to have to pull this one soon anyway, unless you want a guy who's in the WWF. And it's not going to be long before Teddy shows up in Houston and announces his intention. Now, Jim Ross, in the previous match, had said, they're calling me back to the locker room for an interview, which tells me, okay, when they put together this show, they clearly had no idea that, yes, this is supposed to go before the Eddie Gilbert interview. So just move the Steiner and Sting tag up, then air this, and then go to your commercial, and then come back with the Eddie Gilbert thoughts on it. But what do I know about production, okay? Well, I feel like Paulie and Cavallo. What do I know about the restaurant business?
I don't know anything about the restaurant business. Nothing. All I know is to sit down and order a meal. I don't know how to make a restaurant.
What do I know about the wrestling business? All I know is to sit down and watch the weekly TV. So Jim Ross is in the locker room with the new UWF champion, Big Bubba Rogers. And Skandor Akbar is there too. So, okay, so the reveal was spoiled, yes. But I guess we have to give this horribly mediocre promo a manager. Time to explain why he dumped the One Man Gang. Is he going to say, yeah, he was going to the WWF, and I was just going to dump him anyway, so I need to get somebody new to keep myself relevant here.
When you go out with that lackadaisical attitude and that complacency and devastation, you get your walking papers. That should explain it for the One Man Gang. You got a little lazy gang, and I don't tolerate it, and you know it. And as for Big Bubba, I paid a big premium because he's a big nasty diabolical individual, and I'm going to serve notice from here on out, whether it be Dr. Death or Ted DiBiase or anybody else that wants to cast their head in a circle I will gladly oblige. Now, if it's long green this man needs, I can supply it. As I've said before, devastation is still number one. It amazes me at my managerial genius, because I'm always one step ahead of everybody else in this business. The general and the godfather tells you something, you go to the bank, and this man's going to make a lot of trips.
I was starting to have second thoughts of maybe I was a little too hard on Akbar until he referenced Ted DiBiase. Like, who the hell is that guy? Is he going to stick around and challenge Big Bubba now that Ted DiBiase is leaving? I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Oh, my goodness gracious. And he won't let Big Bubba talk. And we know that he would eventually figure it out. It's probably because he's so new in the business. It's just that I find Akbar so generic on a number of different levels, especially compared with the managers that I'm accustomed to, not only in the WWF, but the guys in Crockett as well. Even Paul Jones, it felt like there was a certain zest to him that I'm not getting out of Akbar. As Jim Ross reminds us that Magnum TA will be joining the commentary team in 2 weeks, but he does it in such a way to make it seem like that Magnum is going to return to action. They actually said they were going to air one of his matches next week, but didn't say, oh yeah, one of the matches is from 1984. It's not current. Guy was in a serious auto accident and is never going to be back, but they always seem to kind of leave the impression or leave that door open when there was just no chance of that happening. But indeed, this is the end of the UWF as we know it, and this is the end of UWF TV for May 2nd, 1987. Now, there's been a question about when the Adams Division podcast will be coming out. We had to delay it a little bit because Steve was away with his family, but we'll be taping that, unless there's another act of God that happens, we'll be taping the rest of it this Thursday, and it's certainly going to be out in advance of WrestleMania, since that's the general theme of the entire thing. Now, on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, in their kind of Influence in Pro Wrestling series, they talk about something that is near and dear to the heart of everybody who is around my age, and that would be VHS tapes. And just being able to go to the rental store, Coliseum video tapes, didn't really have as many of those for, like, non-WWF promotions. But even as a kid, I really didn't care. It was just going through every single tape that Blockbuster, in my case, or there are actually some other video stores at the time. I know Townline Video in my city had nearly the same phone number as my house. And when people would call, my dad used to like to screw with them and say, well, we don't have that movie. But then he would recite a list of movies that we did happen to have on VHS. But yeah, that's so very important in wrestling, is those VHS tapes, to kind of familiarize yourself with not only really kind of the history of it, you know, to be able to watch the first WrestleMania or the second WrestleMania. I feel like I rented WrestleMania 2 on a far too frequent basis. It's not like I like it. I always say it's good after the Moolah match, and yet I would sit there through it, because as a kid you have patience for that sort of thing. And also it was the 80s, and what the hell else were we going to do? I mean, you know, we didn't have portable video games at that point. Should also mention, you know, another influence, wrestling magazines. Stu Sachs, I saw, is retiring a little bit later this year, and I just think back to all those magazines that I can't find in my mother's house. All manner of junk I can find. I can find my old Matchbox cars, but I can't find any of my WWF magazine, my Pro Wrestling Illustrated, my Inside Wrestling from back in the day. I really wish I still had that. Also, in another podcast that you'll find me on a semi-regular basis, the Place to Be podcast this week. This past Monday on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, covering SummerSlam Fever 1990, that USA Network special that aired about a week before SummerSlam. Kind of a mix of a few squash matches and matches between named guys. So certainly a lot of fun. And speaking of fun, it is time for another exciting edition of YouTube Comment Theater. We got quite a few, a couple dozen on this one. I'm not going to go through all of them. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left by what I'm going to presume are actual users who will hopefully have names that are easy for me to read. Sometimes I stumble over them, and there's a lot of letters and numbers, you know, kind of mixed in with each other. Anyway, we'll start with an easy one. Rob Miller, who says, I like that this was before that stupid Red Rooster gimmick they gave Terry Taylor. I don't think I would ever use the word like and Terry Taylor in the same sentence. It's just really not my thing. Doc the Metal Freak says, I think this might have been one of the last appearances for the one-man gang before he headed to the WWF. I will try not to mention the Akeem gimmick in this comment, by the way. What? You just did! I mean, you're like, I'm not going to mention this? Well, in saying that you weren't going to mention it, you actually just did. Nick Pez says, Chris Adams was stupid for going back to world class. He could have been one of the UWF stars to be scooped up by WCW when it was swallowed up at the beginning of 1988. They didn't take many. Sting, Steiner, Williams, Gilbert, Sheepherders. Taylor too, but he went to the WWF soon after. Well, yeah, it was because Taylor got caught making fun of Dusty Rhodes behind his back. And Chris Adams believed not wanted by JCP because of some of the things in his background. Patchy Wolf said, I saw this match and it kept me on the edge of my seat from beginning to end. And yeah, it's a pretty good match. I mean, I wouldn't say it's in the top 100 of matches that I've ever seen in my life, but pretty fun and unique big man match, just for the fact that it's two heels going at each other. I still question the way you do the Big Bubba thing, and I'm not talking about spoiling the reveal. It's basically the template of how they turned Lex Luger heel in WCW at the 91 Great American Bash, where Harley Race just comes down to the ring, and then you have an interview afterwards, like, oh yeah, I'm with him now, and he's a heel. Like, not exactly the greatest way to go about it, I think. Kevin Payton says this is the start of Taylor's upcoming heel turn. Yep, that would be consummated within a couple of weeks. Shane Sampson says, I was at this event. It was an awesome show. Most of the matches wasn't televised. Okay, that's not the best grammar in the world, but yeah, there were more matches shown on this Oklahoma, 2 weeks of TV at a time. Roy Chafin says, this is the Jim Ross is needed in AEW. Well, unfortunately, we are now 33 years on from this show, and that Jim Ross ain't coming back. It's just a fact of life. King Sports says, WWF turned Big Bubba and One Man Gang into cartoon character. LOL, Big Boss Man and Akeem, LOL. Well, you can't argue with the fact that they were somewhat successful in those characters, particularly the Boss Man, who had two different runs as two completely different characters as the Big Boss Man. And with Akeem, I still argue that the One Man Gang, that character had become stale by the middle of 1988. Is it silly? Yes, but there's no limit to the number of silly characters that there's been in pro wrestling history. And now, finally, a callback to last week. Roderick King, again, with a comment. Stan Lee presents Marvel Wrestling Federation. I don't understand why you're leaving that comment on this video. Like, why are you doing it? And secondly, why am I actually reading it? So that's probably a sign. That'll do it for YouTube comment there. If you would, and if you haven't already done so between now and next week's show, if you could leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Apple Music, or wherever fine reviews are accepted for podcasts. I don't know, Reddit? Do they still have a podcast thing there? I don't know. I really don't venture into there. I don't have an account or anything like that. But leave a 5-star review. Leave a glowing review. Tell a friend about Greetings from Allentown, because that provides what is known as social proof that you enjoy listening to this podcast. And I can't control the volume of my voice. Makes me think of the old Chris Matthews bit on SNL. Just retires in the middle of his freaking show. What a way to go out. Like, you'd be like hassled by like all these people and then just retire in the first 5 minutes of your show and just turn it over to another guy. Hopefully I don't end up like him. And I probably won't, because next week's show is going to be a good one in that for these next 3 weeks, I decided to choose shows leading into WrestleMania. It's not maybe not like the go-home show, quote-unquote, but shows that are pretty close to the actual WrestleMania. And I decided to pick one from the 80s, one from the 90s, and one from the 2000s. I've kind of gone back and forth on the ones from the 90s. But the one for the 80s, I was trying to find one from 1986 in advance of WrestleMania 2, because I have not covered a show that has that build included. I did a February of 86 edition of All American, but they hadn't really started pushing, I think. Bundy and Hogan, that doesn't get established until the Saturday Night's Main Event on March 1st. So you got the little 4-week window in March. So accordingly, I'll be doing All-American Wrestling from March 30th, 1986. I was wholly unimpressed with the weekly TV of Championship Wrestling and All-Star around this time. All-Star is all tag matches. It drives me absolutely insane for early 86. Even though you got Gorilla and Jesse Ventura on the call during that time period from the summer of 85 when Jack Reynolds leaves to WrestleMania 2 when Jesse splits for a while. It's all tag matches. It's very annoying. But All-American, you got Gene Okerlund on there, and you got a lot of the celebrities from WrestleMania 2. You get a rundown of the guys who are in the Battle Royal, both the wrestlers and the football players. So I look forward to covering that one. Thank you so much for listening, and do join me next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Guys are pushing me a little bit on it. I think I've made up my mind. I've made my point clear. Jim, nice seeing you. Hi, everybody. Maybe some of them.